Journalist Neil Sheehan has spent the better part of the last 26 years trying to learn the truth about America's involvement in Vietnam. Sheehan first covered Vietnam in 1962 for UPI. 2 years later, he joined the New York Times. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg gave Sheehan a smuggled copy of the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret history of the war, commissioned by Robert McNamara. Sheehan brought it to the Times. The Times published it. The Pentagon Papers were an invaluable source for Sheehan's new book, an 800-page history of the war in Vietnam, focusing on the life of Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann. According to Sheehan, Vann's military influence made him the third most important American in Vietnam. Vann first went there in 1963. His efforts to expose corruption in the South Vietnamese Army made him something of a renegade within the military and a hero to the press. Vann retired from the military in 1963, then returned to Vietnam as a civilian in 1965 to head the pacification program. In 1971, he was placed in charge of all military and civilian operations in central Vietnam, an unprecedented appointment for a civilian. Sheehan writes, "Vann saw much that was wrong with the war, but he could never bring himself to conclude that the war itself was wrong and unwinnable." John Paul Vann died in Vietnam in a helicopter crash in 1972. By the end, he had become a victim of his own self-delusions, and Sheehan thinks his story parallels the story of America's military involvement in Vietnam. Sheehan's new book is called A Bright Shining Lie. I asked Neil Sheehan if he was motivated to write this book by a sense of anger at having been misled and deceived as a reporter covering the war in Vietnam.
It was less out of being out of anger. It was more out of a sense that I wanted to leave something behind other than another magazine article or another newspaper story. I'd spent all of my career covering the war, first in Vietnam and then covering the Washington end. I never managed to escape the war. I went there in 62 as a young reporter on my first assignment, and I got the Pentagon Papers for the Times in 1971. And then found myself at John Vann's funeral in 1972, and going to the funeral lit a candle in a way for me. And so I decided to write a book about him, because I thought through him I could tell the story of the war.
Why did he seem like the right person to choose as the subject to tell the story of the war?
Well, the idea came to me at the funeral. I went because John had been my friend. I'd met him in 62 when I first went to Vietnam. And when he was killed, I went to the funeral at Arlington, and it was like being at a strange class reunion. This chapel was filled with about 300 people, and there were all the faces of Vietnam, and this man had brought all of these people together. William Westmoreland was his chief pallbearer, the chief pallbearer of a man who had originally left the Army as a renegade lieutenant colonel, and then went back to Vietnam as a civilian and became our first civilian general. And Edward Kennedy came in a few minutes before the ceremony started, and I thought right away that the last of the Kennedys, his brother, set the country to war. And over on the right was Daniel Ellsberg sitting with the family, who had been Vann's best friend, and they'd both gone in opposite directions on the war. And I had the feeling that we were burying more than John Vann. We were burying an era, that whole era of boundless self-confidence that had led us to the war.
You arrived in Vietnam as a reporter for UPI in 1962. You were one of about 12 full-time correspondents who were there. And you describe yourself and the other reporters who were there as wanting to see America win the war as badly as the lieutenant colonels and the military did.
That's correct, because, you see, we all shared the same outlook in that generation. It was the outlook, what's now called the outlook of the Cold War. All of those beliefs that, first of all, let's remember that America was at the high noon of its power then. And we were also at the high noon of our outlook, what was really, in retrospect, a naive outlook on ourselves and on the world. We believed that, first of all, anything we wanted to do was innately right and good, and secondly, that we would succeed at it. It was that outlook that had really been brought on by World War II, the success in World War II, and then the confrontation of the Cold War. So that the young reporters shared with the advisors in the field, the senior ones generally tended to be lieutenant colonels down through captains and lieutenants, that same outlook that they did. We thought our country ought to be in Vietnam, and we thought we should win this war, and we thought we would win it if we fought it the right way.
You found that one of your best military sources as a reporter in Vietnam in the early 1960s was John Paul Vann, the subject of your new book. And especially after the Battle of Ap Bac in 1963, he was, you thought, exceptionally honest and didn't hold back how discouraging he found the defeat there to be. The American troops lost 5 helicopters. They were trampled, and he didn't conceal his anger or the extent of the debacle from the reporters.
That's right, because by the time Ap Bac occurred, the frustration had been building in John. He had been sent there to get this, to help this South Vietnamese army win its war, and these people didn't want to fight. The leadership didn't want to fight. And they got in this battle with the Viet Cong battalion, and he drove them to try to overcome them, and they wouldn't. And he was furious because he'd been reporting this kind of thing to his superiors in Saigon, and they wouldn't listen to him. They wouldn't, and the South Vietnamese leadership wouldn't change its habits, and he finally just exploded with rage and then really began to talk to the reporters, who by that time knew him well because we'd been out in many operations with him and his advisors in previous months.
There were things that he was just learning that he was up against. For instance, he hadn't realized that Diem, who the head of South Vietnam, had discouraged the army, the South Vietnamese army, from conducting offensive operations that would result in serious casualties because he was afraid of a coup in his country.
That's right, and because Diem saw his army not as a force to crush the communists, which the Americans saw it as, to crush the communist guerrillas, but rather as a force, in the last analysis, to keep him in power. He assumed that if he could hold on to the major cities, if worse came to worse, the United States would send its army to rescue him. And so he did not want to risk his regular army, and he did not want his commanders to take casualties. Unfortunately, our own commanding general in Saigon refused to believe this and was quite naive about the whole thing. When he went to see Diem, Diem said, oh, certainly he had ordered his people to take casualties, to fight offensively, but he hadn't at all.
And John Paul Vann was just learning at this time that he had a lot less control over the South Vietnamese army than he thought he did.
That's right. He was beginning to learn the extent of the limitations that Americans faced in Vietnam. But Vann was a man who reflected all those qualities we admired in ourselves then, and defeat, accepting defeat, was something he couldn't do.
Well, there's interactions that you described that he had with one of the military leaders in the South Vietnamese army named Cao. Am I pronouncing that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And so Vann would hold daily briefings with Cao, basically to build his ego, not to really have a joint leadership of the troops, but to make him feel good so that then he would feel like he was in on the decisions, even though Vann would be telling the troops what to do. And why don't you describe the kind of briefing room that Cao had arranged for these sessions?
Well, he had this extraordinary, it was an attempt to imitate Napoleon's map room. And he had, the walls were covered with maps, and he had this podium at the end of it where the briefer would stand, or the commander would stand to give instructions to his officers. And what Vann was trying to do was to manipulate Cao. He thought that if he got Cao to behave as he called it, like the tiger of South Vietnam, that eventually Cao would begin to act the part. But Cao, unfortunately, declined to act the part when it really came down to it. That is, when he got in battle and Vann wanted him to actually close with the guerrillas and fight, he would never do it. But Vann believed in that kind of thing, that there was a bestseller of that era called The Ugly American that had as one of its heroes Edward Lansdale, the famous CIA agent who'd worked in the Philippines. And Americans had the idea that you could manipulate foreigners then as doing whatever you wanted them to do if you could somehow find the key, and Vann was trying to do this with Cao. Cao manipulated Vann in many ways in the end.
My guest is Neil Sheen, and he's just written a new book called A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam. This book is 16 years in the making. Sheehan was a journalist in Vietnam in the early 1960s, and he also obtained the Pentagon Papers for the New York Times. Vann knew the army had to be restructured in order for America to have a military victory in Vietnam. And he tried to, you think now that he tried to use the reporters, especially David Halberstam as the New York Times, as a way to send his message to Kennedy and to the Pentagon, who followed the New York Times very closely and knew how influential it was.
Well, John thought that, first of all, his own commanding general in South Vietnam wouldn't listen to him, and he was trying to get out the truth about the war, and he believed that he could get it out through the reporters. And Halberstam happened to be then, of course, the correspondent for the Times, and obviously had the best audience. The New York Times attracted the most attention in Washington when a dispatch was published in it, and so he concentrated on David. But he thought, you see, he assumed, as we all assumed, that the American system in that period was rational. That if you got the facts out, those at the top, the president and those around him, would take action to change things. As it turned out, the American system by the 1960s wasn't rational. It would not accept bad news and would not react to facts. It simply would go on and persist with its own preconceptions. But John was under the illusion that it would. We were too. We reporters believed the same thing. But unfortunately, it was no one realized then the extent to which our military and political leadership was really deluded.
What was a briefing with Van like?
Well, John had a brilliant and a mind with this extraordinary analytical capacity, and he could go right to the heart of a matter. And let me give you an example: the advisors would other advisors, the advisors in general, would point out to you that the United States was in fact arming the Viet Cong guerrillas in South Vietnam by giving the militia on the Saigon side good new American weapons that were considerably more advanced than the bolt-action French rifles the guerrillas were using that they'd inherited from the French War. What John would do is to sit you down and say, look, I have 716... don't hold me to that precise number, but he'd have a precise number, outposts in my division zone, and we're putting X number of weapons into them every month, and we're losing them at this rate, and look, we're building a formidable enemy out there. He would give you precise information, which over a period of time enabled you to really analyze the situation and changed the reporting, not only to make it more informative in terms of the facts that were in it, but it became qualitatively different. It was better reporting, and he was really the one who was behind that. He was the one who taught us that.
In 1963, when his tour of duty was up, he retired, and the reporters were so grateful to him for his honesty with them that they gave him a little send-off. They gave him an engraved ashtray that said, John Van, good soldier, good friend. And in the send-off, David Halberstam thanked him, and he said, every time we cabled a story, we worried about hurting your career. And then you say, John Paul Van said in response, you never hurt me any more than I wanted to be hurt. And those words have much more significance to you now, having uncovered some of the things that you did about John Paul Van's past. He couldn't possibly have gotten promoted to a higher rank than he had already held as lieutenant colonel.
Well, he could have gone to colonel, but not to general. And that's what counted for him, to him.
And this was a secret. Tell why he couldn't.
Well, he had a dark sexual side, which I discovered after I began to write the book, that had come really out of his childhood. He had pulled himself up by sheer force of will from a childhood of extreme poverty and degradation in Norfolk, Virginia, and from a mother who rejected him and left great psychic scars on him. And he turned out to have this, as I said, dark sexual side, and had been almost prosecuted, almost court-martialed, for statutory rape because of an affair with a 15-year-old babysitter. Now, none of us, and so this had really put a black mark on his military career. He would have made colonel, but he would not have made general because the Army would not have promoted a man like that to general officer. And so he actually was going to retire. We did not know that. We thought he was constantly risking his career. The fascinating thing about the man was that he did have moral courage. So you have this mixture of a man who was deceiving because he knew his Army career was over, but at the same time who did have moral courage. He might have taken on a commanding general. It's a might have been, we'll never know. But it added this extra dimension to him, which fascinated me and was one of the reasons why I found him a much more interesting character when I started to write the book than I ever realized he would be.
Well, even at this point where you thought, so here was someone finally really being honest with the press corps, his motives weren't completely honest.
Well, John is always a mixture of motives. And I think his motives in being honest with us were honest. That is, he really did want to get out the truth about the war, because he went back to Washington and tried and almost briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff, started a campaign at the Pentagon. The question was that, in retrospect, was his willingness to take risks. We thought he was risking his career because he was taking on the commanding general. It turned out he didn't have a career left to risk because he was not going to ever make general officer. That was the rub. The question of moral courage is that he did have it, but he was also deceiving us.
After Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann left Vietnam as a military man, he returned as a civilian. And I want to talk with you about that chapter of his life after we take a short break. My guest is journalist Neil Sheehan. His new book about John Paul Vann is titled A Bright Shining Lie. Sheehan reported from Vietnam in the early 1960s for UPI and later for the New York Times. In 1971, Sheehan obtained the Pentagon Papers for the Times. 16 years ago, he took a leave of absence from the Times to begin writing this book about John Paul Vann. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Neil Sheehan is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam. John Paul Vann returned to Vietnam as a civilian in 1965, and he was with the Agency for International Development's Pacification Program. What exactly was his job?
Well, he started out as a province representative for AID, which had the main responsibility for the civilian pacification program. He went to work in the most dangerous province, in fact, in the Saigon area, a place called Hau Nia, west of Saigon. And he gradually rose up through the system till he finally ended up as really our first civilian general. He was on detail to the army and a corps commander. He commanded a corps region, the mountains and the central coast, before he was killed in June of 1972.
Did he become more corrupt in this second round in Vietnam?
Well, what happened to John was one of the tragedies of Vietnam. He was a complicated man, and that made him more fascinating to me because he was even more symbolic of the American venture in Vietnam with all of its contradictions and complexities. But what happened to him was that he couldn't give up the war. He had up to Tet 68, which was the surprise communist offensive that broke the will of the American public to continue the war. He had up to then managed to maintain a sense of reality about the war because he kept his professional honesty in one compartment of his life and this private side of his, which was full of deceits, in another compartment. But after Tet, when the country turned against the war, John couldn't give up on the war. He then began to rationalize the reasons why we should continue in Vietnam and came up with these ideas that were incorporated into the Vietnamization program under Nixon. And then he began to lose his compass and to lose his grip. And when he died, he was really fighting for this kind of illusions that had led us to Vietnam in the first place.
Why do you think that a man who understood some of the problems of corruption and loss of control among the South Vietnamese army and one of the first people to petition the American government to try to reform the way the war was being fought, why do you think he was so intent on continuing with the war when America was beginning to lose militarily?
Well, you see, first of all, he was a marvelous soldier who was most at home in war. That satisfied him emotionally more than anything else. He tried working as a defense a business executive for a while at home, was terribly bored with it, went back to Vietnam. For John, war was the most fulfilling thing he could do. Nothing was boring. Everything was important. Everything was urgent. And then he had this personal side of him, which he could satisfy in Vietnam in a way he could never do in the United States. And so the war gradually, and also he invested his own career in the war. He Everyone else went to Vietnam for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. John went and he stayed over the better part of 10 years. And by the time 68 came along, he had invested so much of himself in the war, he couldn't give up on it. So he began to rationalize and say that, well, we could win through this Vietnamization program, that is, by turning things over to the South Vietnamese while we withdrew the Americans. It was an illusion. But that's what finally destroyed him. I think the personal needs, the war met his professional and his personal needs so much that he couldn't give up on it, and so it finally devoured him. And that was one of the tragedies of Vietnam, but also, to me, one of the fascinating things about the man. Because you see, when I decided to write this book, what I wanted to do was to write a book that would tell what really happened in Vietnam and why it happened. And I wanted to do it in a way that Americans would accept. That is, they would read it because it was a story told through the life of a man whose life was really a novel. And Van was that figure to me. He had summed up the war, and yet he summed it up in a fascinating way that I thought would help the American reader to come to grips with the war because they would see it in human terms.
Your two major sources, your two most important sources for this book were John Paul Van's papers, which you had access to, and the Pentagon Papers, the papers that you had brought to the New York Times for publication. In the Pentagon Papers, what were there one or two most important things that you learned from it that helped inform this book and your overview of the war?
Well, the Pentagon Papers remain the best official archive of official documents, and still is the best archive of official documents that we've come up with on the war. And what the Pentagon Papers were useful to me for was a concrete evidence of this delusion under which the American military and political leadership was operating, because the Pentagon Papers are their memoranda, their telegrams, their messages, that is, the messages of the generals and the statesmen of this country. And so they were invaluable to me. John's papers were enormously valuable because he kept pretty good papers over the years. They tended to be spotty at points, but he kept some marvelous stuff, which gave you insights into important historic moments in the war. Go ahead.
When Daniel Ellsberg offered to leak the Pentagon Papers to you, did you have any doubts about having them published? Did you fear that this would be perhaps an unpatriotic act and that it would damage America's credibility? Did you have any of those fears or doubts?
Oh, no, I didn't. And this is without getting into the whole business of news sources. That's another story I've never gotten into. But I had no fears that these papers were going to endanger the security of the United States. There were no military secrets in those papers. They were filled with political and historical secrets, which would make a lot of people angry who had held senior positions in this country. But those papers belonged to the American public, and they were the record of the war. The public had a right to those papers. I mean, the American public had paid for those papers with their lives of their sons and with the treasure of this country, and I had no qualms whatsoever. I think that was true of others at the New York Times who were involved in the whole thing. We felt those papers belonged to the public and had to be published.
What were the consequences you feel you had to face for publication of it? Any harassment or consequences to your journalistic career?
Well, Richard Nixon was quite unhappy over the whole thing and didn't want to prosecute the publisher of the New York Times, but they thought for a while they would prosecute a reporter. And they got a grand jury going and investigated me for quite a while, for 6 months or so, and sent FBI agents around to question my neighbors and subpoena my checking accounts. And it kept me, it ate up my life for 6 months. I spent every day talking to the lawyers, and then they finally gave up. It just sort of melted away.
Was it hard for you to be a practicing journalist after you became the man who got access to the Pentagon Papers?
No, I had trouble in the period in which they were investigating me, and I was having my time taken up talking to the lawyers about what the latest move the Nixon administration had made. But I didn't have trouble with military sources, for instance, if that's what you mean, because mm-hmm. I had always maintain my credibility as a journalist by keeping whatever I wrote in the news column separate from my own opinions, and had been very rigorous about that. And I think people I knew understood that, and they continued to see me and accept and talk to me.
This is perhaps an absurd question, but if you knew then what you knew now, if you had more information when you were covering the war, how would you have covered it differently? Do you think you would have been allowed to?
I wouldn't have been allowed to. You know, quite recently, someone, he was the deputy ambassador in Saigon. It's called Deputy Chief of Mission in the State Department. Officialese came up to me and said, "Oh, God, why didn't we know this in 1960 or 61 or 62 or 63? And I said, "Bill, if we had, you would have been fired if you had, or you'd lost your job if you had tried to make people believe it. And I certainly would not have been able to write it as a journalist. You would have been fired as a subversive." I was awfully glad when I was a young UPI reporter in Vietnam, writing things that contradicted what the generals were saying, that I had belonged to the Republican Club at Harvard. You have to remember that was an era in which when you questioned authority, you were immediately suspect. And if we had really known the things about Vietnam we know now and had questioned the wisdom of the United States being there at all, I don't think you could have practiced journalism. We didn't know. And our ignorance was, to some extent, a professional protection.
Where do you go now? You've spent most of your professional life writing about the war in Vietnam in one way or another, 16 years spent researching your new book. Is the war behind you now, or are you ready for a brand new subject?
I don't really know what I'm going to do next. I'm at peace with myself. I set out to try to put the war in perspective for myself and for my country. And I've done the best I can in this book to tell what happened in Vietnam, what really happened there and why it happened. And I'll go on now and do something. What I'll do, I don't really know. Right now I'm busy with the publication of it, but I've always stayed busy all my life, and I'm sure I'll find plenty to do.
There were many surprises for you along the way writing this book. If you could sum up for us, and I know this is an impossible thing to ask, what the greatest change has been for you in your understanding of the war?
I came away with it realizing that there was a great sense of inevitability about the war, that given the political and military leadership of this country in the post-World War II period, we were destined to fight that tragic war in Vietnam, and a tragedy for ourselves and for the people of Indochina. When you look at the men involved, the men who made the decisions, and their view of the world, you realize that they wouldn't have done anything else other than what they did, because they rejected alternative courses when they were offered to them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Neil Sheehan, and his new book, A Bright Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam, is published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.